This podcast is presented by Dread Hollow. This year, they have three terrifying haunts and what is already one of the best haunts in all of America that you can get into. They have the Crane Toy Factory, the Blood Harvest, and Ricketts Revolt. You do not want to miss out on these terrifying haunts this year. Haley and I, we go every year, so you'll see us there, and we want to give you a chance to win some tickets to Dread Hollow. All you have to do, if you want to win tickets from me, is just tell me via Instagram, at RealJakeMoore, just shoot me a DM. What was the highest grossing horror movie of 1996? If you can tell me that, a pair of tickets to Dread Hollow is going to be yours. You can also head on over to ESPNChattanooga.com where you can enter the win your own pair of tickets by clicking on the banner on our homepage. You can also do that on the ESPN 95.3 app. You do not want to miss the terrifying sights and sounds at Dread Hollow this year.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Now you're all in big, big trouble.
Suspect.
This is how I went.
All right, we are back here on the Watch It podcast for an episode that I have been very much looking forward to this whole year, because this year is when I started the Ultimate What to Watch Guides, where I give you a list of TV shows and movies that I feel like you should be watching. Don't usually have a theme about these. We usually have randomly selected genres, that is, that we're going to go through. But with the month of October and with Dread Hollow Revolt launching in October, I thought it was the perfect time to do a spooky Ultimate What to Watch Guide. So we're going to be doing two horror-based TV shows and six horror movies for you to watch throughout this whole month of October. This is one that I'm very excited about because I love horror movies. But then again, it's one of the more popular genres of film out there. You're more likely to find someone who likes a horror movie as opposed to someone who doesn't want to watch them. I feel like we all have that one person in our life who's like, no, I really not into the scary movies, and they're kind of the outcast of the group because it's October. That's just what you do. Get the jack-o'-lanterns. You get the candy. Samuel Adams Oktoberfest, or your local Oktoberfest of choice. Odd Story has a great one. Shout out to them. Opening up a new location. Very excited to check that out. Right after I recorded this podcast, actually. I think I'm going to head over there. But what you should do after this podcast is you should start these TV shows I'm about to get into. Like I said, we have two TV shows that we're going to hit. One of them has been out for a minute, so that's the first one I'm going to hit on, and that is the outstanding Netflix series, Haunting of Hill House.
Now I want you two to get good rest.
What if I have a bad dream?
Well, I'm sure we can handle any dream you have.
What if I dream that you sent us away into the dark and we get hurt?
Really hurt.
And what if I'm so sad and scared of the dark out there that I put poison in me?
This was one of the first big Mike Flanagan projects that wasn't Hush, because that was the big introduction that everybody had with him. But this was the big Netflix exclusive. This released back in 2018, and it's a big show. You know, it's a 10-episode show, but it is a heavy program to watch because it has its scary moments, of course, but the central conflict of this revolves around a tragic death in the family, a very tight family in some aspects, and a very kind of withdrawn family in a lot of different ways. And Mike Flanagan, you're probably more familiar with some of his modern works, like The Haunting of Bly Manor, which was the follow-up to Hill House, has really nothing to do with it, just other than sharing name and themes in a way. And then he also did Dr. Sleep, which was the follow-up to The Shining, a movie we're potentially going to be talking about a little bit later. And then recently, he also did one of my favorite TV miniseries of all time, which was Midnight Mass with Rahul Kohli and Hamish Linklater and that whole gang there. And it's just really a fantastic job that he does with all these horror entities because, yes, they're very frightening, but in very different ways than you expect from a traditional horror show that you watch. Horror TV shows, to me, sometimes have fallen into this weird hole because I don't count shows like Dexter or You as being horror stories. Those are more thrillers. But when you get into true ground-based horror, the selection of shows gets few and far between. Or selection of quality shows, rather. I would classify Stranger Things as a horror show. I would classify, of course, American Horror Story as a horror show. Bates Motel, I would throw in there. I would even kind of say the first three or so seasons of The Walking Dead, I would classify as a horror show. But outside of that, you start getting into projects like Castle Rock, Lovecraft Country, and Constantine, The Stand, which they're scary in their own right, but they don't quite have that impact that shows like Haunting of Hill House and everything else does, especially Haunting of Hill House, because Haunting of Hill House combines this intense kind of ghostly fear, which in my opinion is kind of the hardest thing to get right in a horror movie because ghosts themselves, like I said, this is just me, are not inherently scary. They're just not. But Haunting of Hill House finds a way where they're really creepy. They're very creepy because what Mike Flanagan does, this was the big thing when the show came out that people would not stop talking about, is the background details on the show. So one of my favorite things, I've talked about this before, I talked about this specifically regarding some other horror movies that we talked about previously on Ultimate What to Watch Guides, like The Lighthouse and such, is I love when you can watch something and there's slight details that you notice with subsequent viewings. And Haunting of Hill House is like the king of that. It's like what made the show popular is because this house, the titular Haunting of Hill House, it's an old house. There's a lot of ghosts that roam those halls, some of which are very connected to certain characters. And if you rewatch the show, you always seem to notice some kind of new ghost or something odd moving around in the background. So I've rewatched this show three times now at this point, including my first ever watch of this. And like I said, every episode, every time I rewatch, there's just something new and something very creepy that you notice in the background. And this show also has some remarkable performances from a rather outstanding cast. This was Victoria Pedretti's first major role. She plays Nell Crane. She's probably best known now as Love from You. We also have Oliver Jackson Cohen. He plays her twin brother, Luke. We, of course, have Kate Siegel, this being a Mike Flanagan project. You can expect that she's going to be in this. And, of course, Michael Huseman, who played Stephen Crane, also known as Dario Naharis from Game of Thrones. He gives an outstanding performance. He's kind of the successful brother of the bunch. And we also have great performances from Henry Thomas and Carla Gugino, who are, once again, staples of Mike Flanagan projects. If you somehow haven't been able to watch this, highly recommend it. It's streaming exclusively out on Netflix. But speaking of another Netflix exclusive that we're going to be talking about today, we have the very recently released Dahmer on Netflix.
What are you going to do? I told you. We're gonna hang out. We're gonna watch a movie. We're gonna take some pictures. And I'll pay you.
This is gonna be Ryan Murphy's Jeffrey Dahmer series. It's gonna be quite different than some other things that he's made as a creator, and it's very different from other Jeffrey Dahmer stories that we've seen, and there's been a lot of them really at this point. We had My Friend Dahmer, which recently released. And then also we have the highly forgotten about but kind of underrated Dahmer with Jeremy Renner as Jeffrey Dahmer. And this one's going to be a little bit different because the early episodes They do primarily focus on Jeffrey Dahmer and his killings and how he came to be who he was. But around the halfway point of this show, it shifts less about him and more into the victims and their families and the overarching outcomes that happened from the extremely disturbing case of Jeffrey Dahmer. And I'm not going to lie to you guys, this series is not for the faint of heart, to say the least. It's one of the most disturbing television series that I've ever watched. Ryan Murphy, he dials up some of the things that he did very effectively in American Horror Story. The season I'm mainly going to be referencing here is Asylum. He takes a lot of those environmental elements, a lot of the performance elements, and I should mention that Evan Peters is the one who plays Jeffrey Dahmer. Remarkably, I will add there, very creepy, very sinister, but just has this level of nuance that is unsettling, but also sympathetic in a weird way. Last podcast on the left said it pretty well regarding Jeffrey Dahmer. But the episode in question is going to be the sixth episode of the series. This one is called Silenced, and it's about one of Jeffrey Dahmer's victims. I don't want to spoil too much about how this episode is so creative and it's so effective and it's so devastating, but it's one of the most memorable episodes of television that I've ever watched. I always call it on this podcast, I call it their Emmy episode. This is the best and the brightest that this show has to offer. And this show was at its best when it was less about Dahmer himself and more about other people that were affected by the crimes. And I understand the controversy behind this show, specifically when it relates to the Glinda character, because she technically didn't exist in the capacity that the show displays. But I'm not exactly mad about that, because I still found that character to be effective in what they were trying to do and highlight some of the negligence on the police department's fault in the Jeffrey Dahmer case. But episode 6, Silence, that is going to be the one that sets this apart from everything else. Episode 4 was also a particularly great episode. And then episode 8, episode 3, which if you were a fan of the My Friend Dahmer movie that came out, I believe that was in 2018, then this is probably going to be an episode that you'll like a lot. It's a very unsettling series. It's a very disturbing series that I still highly, highly, highly recommend. Evan Peters is phenomenal in this. The cinematography in this is unsettling, brooding, and also the score is pretty great. They incorporate these whale sounds into the score, which if you know me, I love a good score. I love a good soundtrack. This one, it really takes it up a notch. So check this one out on Netflix if you're up to it. Like I said, this is not a series that I necessarily am going to recommend to everybody, but if you're into true crime and if you have a pretty strong stomach, then I would recommend Dahmer, or excuse me, Monster, the Dahmer Story, I guess is the proper name for this show. All right, before we get into the movies, I want to take a quick break, let you know about some giveaways that we have going on here on the station. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. Don't miss out on Dread Hollow this year. That is going to be one of the best haunted houses in the nation, and it's located right here in Chattanooga off Browns Ferry Road. This year, they have three haunts in one with Dread Hollow Revolt. I go every year, and I want to see you there, so I'm giving you a chance to win two tickets to Dread Hollow this year. All you have to do to win these tickets from me is tell me what the highest grossing horror movie of 1996 was. That's all you have to do. Just shoot me a DM on Instagram or Twitter, and those tickets, they're going to be yours. You can also head on over to ESPNChattanooga.com and click on the banner. Enter to win some tickets there. And also be sure to check out Press Row and The Word with G, as Greg Wells and David Pascal, they're going to be giving away tickets there as well. You really do not want to miss out on Dread Hollow. Like I said, I go every year. I have an absolute blast. It's very scary. The costumes, the sets that they do, very realistic, very believable, and very fun. So once again, all you got to do is tell me, what was the highest grossing horror movie of 1996? And you and a friend are heading to Dread Hollow. We are back here on the Watch It podcast doing our spooky ultimate what to watch guide. We hit the TV shows. We did Haunting of Hill House and Dahmer, two Netflix shows, two very, very effective, creepy, but very entertaining Netflix shows that you're going to find. But now it's time to switch over to movies. And we have several categories that are specific to the horror genre. It's usually in the ultimate what to watch guide. It's kind of a free reign, if you will. You can really go wherever you want. There's no real rules. Sometimes I limit it to certain decades. And the big thing is that the genres are randomly selected. So I wanted to do subgenres here of the horror movie world. So we have classic horror comedy, horror action, realistic horror, which that one was interesting, a critically acclaimed horror film, and found footage. So I think we need to just get this ball started off in the perfect way with an all-time classic. In my opinion, the most influential horror movie of all time. Even outside of horror, I would go ahead and just claim this as one of the most influential movies of all time, and that is going to be George Romero's Night of the Living Dead.
The dead who live on living flesh. The dead whose haunted souls hunt the living night. Of the living dead.
Once again, those trailers, man, from the 60s and early 70s, there was nothing like those. But George Romero's 1968 classic, Night of the Living Dead, it doesn't really get much better than this, to be honest. This was the first zombie movie as we know them. I know White Zombie technically was the first back in 1930s with Bela Lugosi, but this was the first to have the flesh-eating ghouls of the night come out, or ghouls of the day even, that we see. Not exclusive to the night. But Night of the Living Dead, it's George Romero's first movie here, and he absolutely knocks it out of the park. Such a creative story, such a creepy story. Right from the beginning, when you have Barbara and her brother driving up the hill and that creepy score just kicks in, they're visiting the graveyard. I mean, it's just classic horror. It feels like that kind of changing of the times from a mix of that, where you have that classic kind of universal horror feel with the spooky graveyards and the fog rolling in that, like I said, Universal just made so well in movies like Dracula, The Wolfman, and The Mummy. And then you kind of have the beginning of the exploitation era of horror films come in with some of the grotesque visuals and the interesting creature design and some of the kills in this movie. I mean, man, this is probably one of my most watched movies of all time. I remember the first time I ever watched this, I was 7. It was on Halloween, and I could not believe what I was watching. I thought it was the scariest movie I'd ever seen. And that's the thing with Night of the Living Dead that's kind of such a beauty, is usually you watch horror movies from this era and prior to that, and they don't necessarily hold up. An example of this, I know it's a little bit after Night of the Living Dead, is The Exorcist. I know when that movie first came out, everybody said it was the scariest movie ever made. And I'm sure when it came out, it was horrifying. But you watch The Exorcist today, yeah, it's creepy, but it doesn't quite hold up like Night of the Living Dead does. You know what I mean? It's just not the same that we had there. Because Romero, what he did is it was such an easy formula that was just sitting there, just waiting to be taken, and never happened. And then he came in, he made it unique, and then he created probably the most legendary subgenre of any movie ever with the zombies. In a sense, he invented the modern day zombie with this. And think about how many zombie movies there are, zombie games, zombie TV shows, comic books. None of that would have been possible without Night of the Living Dead. And from an interesting kind of industry perspective, this is one of the most profitable independent movies ever made. The budget for this was $114,000. That was in 1968. Today, that's roughly the equivalent of $941,800. And it grossed $300 million in 1968. That today is the equivalent of nearly $250 million. That's 263 times its budget. That's insane. And for good reason. This is also one of the first movies that ever brought in the MPAA into the mix because it was so violent. And that's part of the reason why it's in black and white. It was 1968, so the option to be in color was there, but not only was it cheaper, they could have more gore effects and not have to use it. This is also one of the first major motion pictures, really, in my knowledge, the first major horror movie to have an African-American lead, with Dwayne Jones, who said that he never watched another zombie movie after he was in this. And he's fantastic in this. Judith O'Day plays Barbara, who is one of the first major scream queens that we had. I know Janet Leigh is the big one, but Judith O'Day needs to have her moment there. And you also have this small cast of characters that also wind around the story here. We have the family that comes in. We have the mechanic guy. We have the sheriff, which the ending of this movie is extremely ahead of its time for all the wrong reasons. No way Romero could have known that something like that would still be an issue in 2020, but here we are. But Night of the Living Dead, man, it's a quick watch, an hour and 36 minutes, just like another movie that's going to be appearing on our list just next. It's a perfect movie to me. Started, like I said, just a global phenomenon with the zombies. And the big thing about this is you can watch this movie for free. It's on Freevee, it's on YouTube, it's everywhere. So if you, for some reason, haven't seen really the movie that started it all, Night of the Living Dead, 1968, directed by George Romero, what are you doing? What are you doing? Go ahead, watch that. That should be your first movie you watch on your roadmap through the month of October. All right, moving on. The next one we had was horror comedy, and I was stuck between two here, but I went with what is honestly one of my favorite movies of all time, An American Werewolf in London.
I'm sorry I'm upsetting you, David, but you don't understand what's going on.
I understand, all right. You're one of the undead, and I'm a werewolf.
Yes, that's right.
Another very popular subgenre of movie, the werewolf movie. The Wolfman is really the first big one that Universal started back in the late 30s, early 40s. But to me, An American Werewolf in London, despite it being more of a comedy, is probably the most effective werewolf movie we have ever had or ever will have. And it's funny that it's directed by John Landis, of all people. If you don't know who John Landis is, when this movie came out, his big movies at the time were Schlock, the Blues Brothers, and he also did Animal House. And for him to come in and make this, it is interesting to me, because this is a totally different movie in some aspects, but in a lot of different ways, it's a very familiar movie to those that I just mentioned. And then after this, he went on to make movies like Spies Like Us, Three Amigos, Coming to America, Beverly Hills Cop. He did everything. He did everything, really, after this. But American Werewolf in London, it's a complicated movie to explain, because you're like, how did they make a whole movie out of this? But it's about these two American college students. They're hiking around England, and then they get attacked by a werewolf. One of them dies, and then the other one becomes a werewolf. But it's you hear that, and you're like, what? How is that? You say it's one of your favorite movies of all time. And it is, because it's how it gets there. It starts slow. It's these two guys just walking around the countryside. They go into this bar, or a pub, rather, and things are just off. There's a pentagram on the wall, and they won't tell them why. They kick them out, and then that's when the werewolf attacks. And from that point, I mean, this movie just goes in a billion different directions, a billion different good directions. The whole sequence where he's in the hospital, it's masterful. He has these dream sequences that are kind of like dreams within dreams at some points. There's some of he's running around the woods hunting, and then there's a bizarre one with these werewolf soldiers, and they're incredibly disturbing, the werewolf dream sequences. And then it has probably my favorite stretch in horror movie history, and it's not even scary what this is. It's just him, the night of the full moon, being in his apartment, listening to Bad Moon Rising, just doing everyday tasks, but you know what's coming next.
B-5, Bo Bum, I smell the blood of an Englishman.
I'm still not hungry.
And I heard this on the Cinemassacre Monster Madness podcast, that every song in this movie has the word moon in it, which I just think is interesting. And it's funny because all the songs in it are very upbeat, and it's juxtaposed against a very violent movie, a very disturbing movie in parts. And if you haven't seen this, I mean, obviously, since it's on this list, I highly recommend it. But this is the one I really recommend you give it the biggest chance of all of these, because you're going to start it and you're like, I don't know about this. But trust me, just stick with it. It's a very fast movie. Like I said, the same runtime as Night of the Living Dead, just an hour and 36 minutes. An American Werewolf in London, 1981, directed by John Landis. You really don't want to miss that. And our next category is action horror, which is one of my favorite subgenres, because there's just a million different things that this could be. A million different things. But in my opinion, and probably the opinion of a lot of other people, the best action horror movie has got to be the shocking Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez collaboration From Dusk Till Dawn.
Okay, ramblers, let's get rambling.
One night is all that stands between them and freedom.
This is my kind of place.
But it's going to be one hell of a night.
We might be in trouble. There are a bunch of fucking vampires out there trying to get in here and suck our fucking blood.
Now, their only chance is to fight back.
Oh, yeah! Yep, this movie is totally awesome, for lack of a better word, because it's really like two movies in one that we get here. The first half of the movie is less horror, but it's more of a crime story, kind of like a classic Tarantino story that we expect, as it follows these two guys, these two brothers. They're out on the road in Texas and in Arizona, New Mexico, and they're on a crime spree, and they're just wreaking havoc all along this area, and they finally find a way to get out of this situation by stealing this family's RV, still holding them as hostages, and heading down to kind of like the Tijuana area to make a little trade-off here, and then they're out free. But they go to this bar. It's an interesting name of the bar. I don't want to spoil the first time you see it, if you haven't seen it, because you have Danny Trejo out front just cooking, just saying some of the funniest lines of dialogue I've ever seen in a horror movie. And that from that point on, this is where things go a little off the rails, because they get to this bar, they're having a great time. There's a Salma Hayek performance, a legendary Salma Hayek dance scene. And then from that point on, the movie changes to just this action vampire movie. And it's just outrageous, everything that happens from that point on. And to me, one of my favorite parts about this movie is George Clooney's performance. He's the lead in this. And it's what's so interesting about it is, like I said, there's two kind of different stories happening throughout this movie, where it's two distinct movies within one. And George Clooney doesn't change his performance at all throughout either of them, notably and intentionally at that, because it's hilarious how you have him in the first part as this stone-cold criminal, and then the vampires come out, and for just like 1 second, he's like, oh my God, what the hell is happening? And then from that point on, he just goes back to being the level-headed criminal that just happens to be dealing with vampires trying to get into this bar that he's in with his hostages. And I'll tell you, the vampire design in this movie is extremely unique. And you should expect that when Greg Nicotero and Tom Savini are going to be doing your effects. Tom Savini also has a role in this movie. Tom Savini, if you don't know, one of the most legendary effects artists of all time in horror movies. He did Dawn of the Dead, the original. He also did the work in this movie. And, of course, he did the effects for Friday the 13th, like that classic effect with the arrow through Kevin Bacon's neck. And this does lend in big time to the action horror part. I'm not necessarily sure if I would call this movie scary or not. Sure, it's shocking in certain aspects, but I don't really know if I would say that this is the scariest movie on this list. That is either going to be our next movie or one of the two following. And our next category was a realistic horror movie. And that one's interesting because I didn't want to get too far into the thriller realm of things, because to me, the big difference between a horror movie and a thriller, it's a fine line. And Logan Nipper, who was on this podcast, he actually asked me this question what is the difference between the two? And for me, the big difference with a horror movie and a thriller is that horror provides a more immediate payoff to scenes of tension, where thrillers are prolonged moments of tension that never reaches its major climactic moment until the final act. And then also wise, there's a big content difference. Thrillers are marked by something being more grounded, and then horror tends to focus on something out of the ordinary. Like in a thriller, it's scary because it's believable, and in horror, it's scary because it's unnatural. And for this next movie, I kind of debated which category it fell into, because you could make an argument really for both sides. But at the end of the day, when I thought about the soundtrack of this movie, it just landed it right into the horror category. So I'll play a little bit of that, and then we're going to get in to Cape Fear. Like, you just hear those big horns and everything, and you know, damn, this movie is going to be something. And, you know, another reason that I decided to lend Cape Fear a little bit more into the horror side of things is some of the visuals that Martin Scorsese opted to use. You know, Max Cady, he comes out of jail, and there's the giant storm clouds surrounding him, the lightning. It's like he is just this bat out of hell who is just re-entered the world, and he is about to wreak some havoc. He almost feels like a slasher villain at times, and that's a good place to start talking about Cape Fear, is because it's another reason I find it to be more of a horror than a thriller, is it places this character kind of in the slasher role into an environment that is not expecting of this at all. The prototypical thriller I like to think of is Gone Girl and Seven. Those are two things where the central conflict lends into its environment very well. Very, very well. But then you think of a movie like Friday the 13th or Nightmare on Elm Street, even Halloween, where there's this central antagonist who is no way similar to what the environment that they're building is. And Max Cady is a perfect example of that. And that's another thing about this movie. Martin Scorsese, this was his kind of... let me start from the beginning on this. So Martin Scorsese, in the late 80s, he made a movie that was called The Last Temptation of Christ with Willem Dafoe. It was like his biblical adaptation, and it was very hard to get that movie made. Very, very hard. No studio was wanting to pick it up because it's controversial subject matter. And eventually it was picked up under the condition that Scorsese had to go on and make a commercial movie following for the studio. So he made Last Temptation, then he made Goodfellas, so that was kind of that middle ground, and then he made Cape Fear. So Cape Fear was the commercial movie, and, you know, if you've seen Cape Fear, I don't know if I necessarily would call this a commercial movie, because it's very disturbing. The relationship that goes on between Juliette Lewis and Robert De Niro, first of all, De Niro in this movie is spectacular.
Counselor? Counselor? Is that you? Counselor, I'm out. Come out wherever you are.
I ain't no white trash piece of shit. I'm better than you all. I can outlearn you. I can outread you. I can outthink you. And I can outphilosophize you. And I'm gonna outlast you. You think a couple of whacks to my good old boy gut's gonna get me down? It's gonna take a hell of a lot more than that, counselor, to prove you're better than me.
I am like God, and God like me. I am as large as God. He is as small as I. He cannot above me, nor I beneath him be.
Yeah, it's not exactly a guy that you're going to be wanting to go toe-to-toe with in this movie. And to once again add on to the credence that this is a horror movie rather than a thriller, Robert Cargill, who wrote Doctor Strange, Insidious, and recently he did The Black Phone with Ethan Hawke, he said that a horror movie is from the perspective of the victim and a thriller is from the perspective of the investigator. Which, if you take that, this movie is mainly from the perspective of Nick Nolte and Jessica Lange, who are being tormented by Max Cady. And another thing with this movie, and this is why this is one of my favorite Scorsese movies, because he's just having a ball with this movie. It's not like some of his other movies where it's very, very serious. Most times in this movie, things are very unbelievable to the point of being ridiculous. Like, the whole final act of this movie, if you haven't seen it, I'm not going to spoil it. There's just a, for you have, I'm referring to this extended moment on a houseboat, and that's all I'll say. That is over the top. It is classic slasher movie, and it's one of the million reasons why I absolutely love Cape Fear. But staying in the realm of critically acclaimed performances, our next category for horror was critically acclaimed horror films, and you had to go with what is easily the most celebrated horror movie of all time.
You've had your whole fucking life to think things over. What good's a few minutes more gonna do you now?
Stay away from me.
Wendy.
Stay away!
Darling, light of my life. I'm not gonna hurt you. You didn't let me finish my sentence. I said, I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm just gonna bash your brains in. I'm gonna bash them right the fuck in.
Yeah, I mean, it had to be The Shining for this category. You heard Jack Nicholson there, one of the best actors of all time, and in my opinion, his best performance was in The Shining as Jack Torrance. You could have picked any scene really out of a hat from that movie. That's just the one that comes to mind when they're on that staircase. You could also do when he's breaking down the door. Or you could pick one of my other favorite sequences in the movie where he's with the bartender, Lloyd. He's like, line him up, Lloyd. God, it's just so, so creepy. And it's also my favorite Stanley Kubrick movie because everything from the opening credits, you get the helicopter sequence of them driving to the hotel, the conversation that they have, just the unsettling nature of everything that happens in that movie. I mean, you heard the score that was playing in the background. I mean, that is just classic horror inside of that. And, you know, it wasn't until very recently that I fully appreciated this movie in its entirety, because obviously I had seen it prior to last year, or 2 years ago rather, but I hadn't really just sat down and dissected it like I do with a lot of other movies. So I sat down, I watched the 4K Blu-ray release of it, and I nearly got up and started over again because I'm just blown away with this movie, and I've seen it a couple times since that. And every time, it's that same feeling as you watch it and you're like, man, that was unsettling, to say the least. It's not only Jack Nicholson, it's the environment of the Overlook Hotel and everything inside of there, how it just is its own alive character. Kind of like I mentioned with Haunting of Hill House, where I rewatch this movie and there's these subtle details I just watch and rewatch, and I notice just new things every time that just lead it more and more down this very, very unsettling path. And it's really awesome and respectable how well done this movie is. And it received a ton of critical praise at the time. Still to this day receives a ton of critical praise now, and for very good reason. I think it's Jack Nicholson's best performance. I think it is the best horror movie, objectively, of all time. And I think it's one of the best settings in movie history. It also has one of the greatest endings of all time. So for some reason, you've been living under a rock, or you've seen The Shining, but you didn't really love it, highly recommend going back, giving it a second chance. Make sure you watch this on the coldest night of October that you can find. So check those forecasts and see what's going to be a good night to take The Shining for another go. Or hell, even if it's for the first time, do not miss out on this. Our next and final category was going to be the found footage category. And I wanted to bring back a movie that I had actually done on my first edition of the Ultimate What to Watch Guide. I've done six of these now, if you factor in this. One of those episodes hasn't been released yet, but this one here, this movie, man, I remember watching this. I had no idea what I was expecting, and I was absolutely blown away. I watched this on Halloween night of 2020, and it's honestly been a movie I've been thinking about ever since, and I wanted to revisit it. And of course, I'm talking about Hell House LLC.
You have heard the rumors about this.
There are no rumors about this place. No rumors. We talked about this.
It's supposed to be haunted.
Hey, man. How many freaks do we have?
Three freaks. Oh, what's going on?
Are you sure?
Five.
You know how I mentioned with Night of the Living Dead how there was just a concept that was just sitting out there and nobody was taking it? Hell House is another example of that. A haunted house business that is occurring in a real haunted house unbeknownst to anybody involved with it. Because I had seen some where it's like, yeah, this haunted house, like it's actually, you know, here for a murder dungeon. Or, oh yeah, I know there's ghosts in there, that's why I'm going. But no movie have ever done it where it was the audience is blind on it. Kind of. I'll touch back on that in a second. And especially the characters, totally out of the loop on what's happening with this abandoned Abaddon Hotel. And where this movie starts so effectively, I mean, it hits the ground running. And that's so important for a horror movie. Because with American Werewolf in London, the first time I watched it, if it wasn't for the soundtrack and that I'm a sucker for a prolonged opening credit scene, that's a really specific thing, but American Werewolf in London had that, so I was in no matter what. With horror movies, something to me has to happen very quickly. Hook me in, get me scared, so I know I'm not wasting my time, because there are so many horror movies out there. I would say it's the most popular genre of movie there is. There's so many of them. They're cheap to make. People love them, even if they're bad. But where this movie starts, it's one of the strongest starts any movie I've seen, horror movie I've seen has. And it's especially effective for a found footage movie because it uses newsroom footage, which I always think is awesome. One of my favorite things, I can't believe it didn't make it into the movie, was in the remake of Dawn of the Dead. There's a whole sequence where it's like a live breakdown of the zombie outbreak. Very, very frightening, honestly, because you buy into it and you're like, whoa. Just, the way it does it is significantly more believable than pretty much everything else. But in this, it starts at the end of the movie. And it's like there's something's happened in this haunted house. And they're doing interviews. They're like, I don't know. And it's just really creepy. You're like, what happened? And then there's just like this still cam footage that they show where all it's like a dark corridor of a basement. You know, people are going down. They're doing the typical haunted house thing. They're jumping around. And then you hear like all this rustling and then these lights and everything is flashing. And then all these people start running up the basement and falling. It just, it's really creepy. It's extremely effective. It's very creepy, and then it goes into the main action of the movie. For a horror movie, I love that, when they do the whole, this is how it ends, and here's how we got there. I love that. I really do. And I know that's not for everybody, but this movie, it takes it, and it runs with it as its central concept, because it is a slow burn, like all of these found footage movies, you know? Cloverfield, Blair Witch Project probably being the most notable one of all time, and so many other ones that they're so cheap to make that there's so many of them out there. As Above, So Below is another really, really profound and effective found footage movie. I could have put that one in there. But with this, it's like you have these characters, and here's the trap that a lot of found footage movies get into, is that the dialogue's not very believable most of the time. It's like people don't actually talk like this, but with Hell House, it's just people trying to start up a haunted house. So you kind of buy into it. You buy into it, and it goes into the same thing I mentioned with Haunting of Hill House and The Shining, where for the first act and a half or so, the scares are extremely subtle. Extremely. It's like a clown animatronic slightly turns its head more than it was 5 seconds ago. Something is over there and something is not. The biggest scare of the first act, of the first two acts of the movie, is this gag with mannequins, which is really frightening. But that's the other thing, is that there's no soundtrack or anything happening under this. It's just like this pulsing from the security cameras and the breathing and footsteps, and all of this is happening. I don't know. It's just the thing with Hell House is that it was the most believable of all these found footage movies to me. And then the last act, man, when the house actually opens, oh my goodness. I mean, it goes totally off the rails there in the best way possible. But Hell House LLC came out in 2016. You can find this one out on Amazon Prime. Highly, highly, highly recommend it. One of the most effective found footage movies of all time. And if that sounds interesting to you, well, I have the perfect thing for you, as I'm going to give you a chance, if you didn't hear earlier, to take you and a friend over to Dread Hollow. It's off Browns Ferry Road. All you have to do is send me a message telling me what the highest grossing horror movie of 1996 was. If you can send me that, I'm going to hook you up with two tickets to Dread Hollow. You can also head over to ESPNChattanooga.com and the ESPN 95.3 app, where you can click on the banner to learn more about Dread Hollow and enter to win there. Also, check out the Word with G and Press Row, as they're going to be giving away Dread Hollow tickets as well on ESPN 95.3. And we're going to have more spooky content for you all throughout the month of October, so don't miss it on the Watch It Podcast.